Hey there.
We have rocks.
We have, yeah, crime and time. We have crime and time and rocks.
And rocks.
So I'm kind of excited about this drink compared to the last one we did.
Okay.
So this is the Astronaut.
Right.
And
what is in it?
It's 1 ounce of light rum, 1 ounce of vodka, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1 dash of passion fruit juice, and garnish with a lemon wedge. Or you can do what I did. It's really cute. You get a cocktail pick and use like the half circle of a lemon rind and then put a cherry in the middle and make it look like a little planet.
It was adorable.
You can see it in our pictures.
See it in the picture on the Facebook, facebook.com/CrimeandTimeOTR.
So anyway, you shake it all together, strain it into an old-fashioned glass filled with ice, and then garnish.
Love.
I'm
very excited about the drink. I think we'll like it.
I think we're going to like this one, too. It kind of smells like a daiquiri to me, which okay. I like daiquiris, so...
I'm not super big on sweet, but I don't think with that much lemon juice, I don't think it'd be sweet.
Oh, there's nothing sweet in this.
Yeah.
There's like literally like the amount of passion fruit juice is a dash.
Oh, okay. I might like it.
Yeah.
So we put it in my glasses that come from the 30s that look like 60s. They're the old-fashioned glass. Well, they're not old-fashioned glasses. They're, I don't even know what they'd be.
They're like...
It's a cocktail glass, yeah, I guess.
But it's a little taller than an old-fashioned,
yeah,
but
it's
slimmer.
It's taller and slimmer, but it's got the gold on the bottom, and it's kind of flaked up to the top. It looks very 60s to me.
They're really cool.
And I thought that was appropriate, given that it's titled The Astronaut.
All right, let's try our drinks, though.
Okay.
It's almost like a whiskey sour.
I was going to say, it reminds me a lot of a whiskey sour. Yep, drinking this.
I will drink this. And there's extra, because
I know, we're going to have to fight over the extra.
I thought...
I get to listen first.
I thought that it would be a little too small for the glasses we were going to use. So I was like, I'll just double the recipe. And then I realized after I made it, I'm like, I should have done 1.5 instead of 2 times.
No, that's totally fine. Well, the other glasses, it would have looked cute in, but I don't know. I like it in these just from the whole 60s vibe.
Yeah, well... We're going to go from the 60s to modern times for my story.
Okay.
So I'm gonna
think I need a straw, though. I feel like this deserves a straw.
Let's get straws. Okay, BRB. Oh, give me one, too.
Oh, look at you.
Not an effing paper straw. Why would you have boba straws?
I have no idea. I don't like boba. And why in the world would I make it?
I could never even imagine you ever in your life having a boba.
No.
Never had it.
They're delicious. She would not like it, though. Okay, I'm going to tell you about a modern-day astronaut, Lisa Nowak.
Okay.
So, she first became interested in space when she was 5. In an interview that was conducted in 2005, she said, "I remember the moon landing and watching those astronauts. That was very exciting."
Uh-huh.
So, she went on to study aerospace engineering at the U.S. Naval Academy. She got a master's degree in aeronautical engineering, and in 1996, she made it through a rigorous selection process and became an astronaut.
Good for her.
Yeah.
We grew up in the age of the Challenger, or of the space shuttle, and if I were smarter, I might have been very interested in space as well.
I've never really been like, I mean, I watched the stuff, but I wasn't interested in the way that you would have to be to do it.
I had Tang. I had freeze-dried ice cream. I had a space pen. My grandparents really were pushing the STEM before STEM was cool.
Before STEM was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2006, she went to space on a mission as a mission specialist on the space shuttle Discovery.
I didn't know we were still sending space shuttles as late as 2006.
Yeah.
I thought we kind of quit with the last explosion.
So that happened. I have it down here. Anyway.
I talk about it briefly.
Oh, okay. Even though being an astronaut was a demanding profession, it did not keep her from having a family. So she...
Good for her.
...married her husband, Richard. He was a classmate of hers from the Naval Academy, and they had 3 children. I believe it was one set of twins, and then I can't remember which, like, if the single came first or second. But anyway... A twins and a single.
Okay.
In one interview, she said, "It's definitely a challenge to do the flying and take care of even one child and do all the other things you have to do, but I learned that you can do it."
I'm not really sure how, so hats off to her, because I only have 2 and I work out of my house on my computer, and I have a hard time doing it all.
And I have no children, and I have a hard time taking care of myself and my dogs that only have to be fed twice a day.
Yes, I have to feed mine 3 times a day. If you listen to the episode from last week, you'll hear us arguing about food with my child.
So, behind the scenes, even though she had this facade of being, like, a go-getter and, like, holding it all together.
Right.
Not so much. There was problems in her personal life.
I'm stunned.
So, before she ever went on her space mission in 2004, she began an affair with a fellow astronaut named William Oflin.
Oh, that makes me sad.
I know. And it's also not a good decision. Like, that's your coworker.
Yeah.
At a high level.
And you were in a very, very competitive, competitive field.
And predominantly male-dominated field.
Right. If you're ever up for the same thing, you can bet that's going to come out from somebody who knows it.
Mm-hmm. So, Oflin trained with Lisa, but they were never in space at the same time.
That's good.
Yeah. So, he was already separated from his wife when they started seeing each other, but in 2005... he and his wife were finally divorced.
But she's not.
She's not.
How in the hell do you do that? I do not understand how you carry on a relationship with someone and then go home and get in bed with your husband. I don't get it.
Well, she did it.
Yeah.
In 2007, Lisa and Richard separated. And so she thought, oh, now was her chance. She was going to start a future with Oflin.
Right.
However, in mid-January, which is only like a couple weeks after she thought that she was going to be with him forever, Oflin let Lisa know that he was in a relationship with Air Force Captain Colleen Shipman.
I'm stunned. Don't affairs always work out?
Well, he wasn't having an affair.
That's true. He wasn't.
So, and he actually, what he and Lisa were not together when he started the relationship with Colleen.
Right. Because she was still with her husband.
Yeah. So she was on, he's on the up and up.
Okay. As much as you can be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess he didn't know she was married.
Yeah. But
anyway, like as far as, you know, the timing of his relationships.
Right, right. No, he was just, she was available and there while he was going through a separation.
Yeah.
That's not uncommon.
Mm-mm. So Oflin said that after he broke the news to Lisa, he realized she was disappointed, but that he thought that she had accepted the news.
As most people would.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to be sad, but...
Well, she didn't really accept the news. So
no. Well. From what I remember of the news story, she did not.
So she had a key to his apartment. He had previously given it to her. And so she goes into his apartment and she gets on his computer and accesses personal emails between him and his new girlfriend, Colleen Shipman.
Okay. This is a very, very highly educated, very logical scientist. In order to be an astronaut, she is a scientist.
Yes.
And she thought it was a good idea to break into someone's house, access their email, and read their private correspondence.
Of things
in their home.
Of things that you would not or should not know about another relationship. Like,
right. All while you're sitting in another home that you have broken into.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So she...
It just goes to show you that, you know...
Yeah.
People are the same whether they're smart, educated, or not.
I know. So in one of the emails, Shipman wrote to Oflin, "We'll have to control myself when I see you. First urge will be to rip your clothes off, throw you on the ground, and love the hell out of you."
Aww.
So...
Ish.
This might be what prompted Lisa to proceed with a trip that made headlines and dubbed her the astronaut.
I remember this.
So while she's still in his apartment, she finds out through the emails that Colleen Shipman is returning from Houston to Orlando, and she decides she's going to confront Shipman.
Yeah.
So Lisa Nowak made the same 900-mile journey, but instead of flying, she went by car. She gets to Orlando International Airport, and she just keeps watch for Shipman. Shipman got in around 1 a.m., but she had to wait a couple hours at baggage claim because her luggage was delayed. So
at no time during this 900-mile drive Or the 2 hours waiting at baggage claim. Does her rational brain think, this is crazy?
I am a crazy person.
This is not reasonable. We've all done crazy, stupid shit for the boy.
But no, your point is well taken. This wasn't like a irrational moment. This was 900 miles of driving, several hours of waiting. She'd already broken into a house. Yeah. Shipman gets out of the airport. She takes a shuttle to the parking area. Lisa Nowak was also on the shuttle. She was wearing a wig and a trench coat. Because that's not suspicious.
She disguised herself?
Yes. And so this is the funny thing. So Shipman notices her because of what she's wearing. Because
it's crazy
but
in
they
Florida.
They didn't know each other. So it's not like she would have identified her.
Right. So she could have not been disguised.
Yeah. So Shipman, gets off the shuttle. She goes to her car and Lisa approaches her and says, hey, my boyfriend didn't show up. Can I get a ride with you? Which is also weird because why would you take the shuttle to parking to wait for somebody?
Right, because they should pick you up at the terminal.
Yeah. So Shipman does not let her in the car.
Good.
But says, I can call someone to help you. And she ends up opening her car window just a little bit. And then Lisa pepper sprays her.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But Shipman was able to drive away and like call the police and stuff. So police quickly apprehend Lisa Nowak. And when they arrest her, they find hundreds of dollars of cash. They found a bunch of printouts of the emails. They found
she printed them.
Yes. Because you needed to see them again.
From the time you push print to the time they're done printing is enough time to let rational thought come back into your brain.
She had lots and lots of time to say, hey, that's...
this is crazy.
Maybe not go through with the whole plan. Maybe I'll just read the emails and then, like, go get drunk.
Right. That's a much better option.
Yeah. So, anyway, nevertheless, that's not what she does. But nope. So they find also in the car pepper spray, a knife, rubber tubing, gloves, a BB gun, a mallet for some reason. They also found a computer disc that had just random images of bondage scenes, which I'm confused about.
That's a little weird.
Yeah. I'm confused about that one.
Yeah.
The other strange thing they found in her car were diapers. So the police report stated that she had space diapers with her so that she wouldn't have to stop for bathroom breaks on her 900-mile drive, which...
So she stole space diapers from work.
That's what the police report says, which that is like the one part that makes sense. If you're driving 900 miles.
But at the point that you're pissing yourself.
She's done it before.
How do you not think? When she's in space.
I know, but that's why I'm like, she's probably like, makes sense.
Oh my God.
Anyway, her attorneys later claimed.
And what if you have to poop?
I don't know. It all happens in space too.
I know, but. In the car is what I'm talking about. If you're in space, fine, that's one thing. That's what you have to deal with. But in the car, if you have to poop, stop at a rest stop.
It only takes like 3 minutes.
Just stop. It should only take 3 minutes.
Yeah. Anyway, her attorneys claimed that the diapers were toddler diapers that were left in the car because she did have toddlers.
She had toddlers and she's carrying on this affair?
Yeah.
I always think about that. I think about, okay... It takes 9 months to grow the baby. But 9 months before that, you liked each other enough to screw. And now they're only two and you're having an affair? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a very short amount of time to go from, we like each other enough to screw, to, I really don't like you and have disdain for you and I'm going to go sleep with him. And drive 900 miles wearing an adult diaper to kidnap someone.
Potentially wear an adult diaper.
Potentially wearing adult diapers. She would still have to stop to change it.
Right. That's what I'm saying. That part of the fact is not a fact. That's still up in dispute.
Yeah.
Because it like, from what I've read after reading all these things, they weren't toddler diapers or space diapers. They were just adult diapers.
Just adult. Well, maybe she was taking care of an elderly parent.
She didn't say that. I don't know.
But yeah, you would think that you'd be able to tell the difference between NASA-issued space diapers and toddler diapers. Toddler diapers will have
toddler diapers on them. Are this big, and they have cartoon characters.
Cartoon characters. Sorry, Dora. Didn't mean to disparage. But you are on diapers. I've seen you on diapers.
Diapers, or Dora's not a real person, so.
I can still apologize to her makers.
So when the police made the ID and identified Lisa Nowak, they told Shipman her name. And Shipman was like, well, that sounds familiar. And she couldn't think of why, but she called Oflin and he confirmed the connection.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's like...
How humiliating.
Prior to this, Colleen Shipman had no idea who this woman was.
Right, because she's just dating a man.
Yeah. So Lisa's in police custody, but even, like, when they get her in custody, all she wanted to do was talk to Shipman. Like, she was just, like, obsessed.
She's very single-minded.
Yeah.
Which I guess is why you're an astronaut, because you're single-minded.
Yeah, like...
You've got your goal.
The mission. So Lisa is charged with attempted kidnapping and burglary with assault. So this made her the first active duty astronaut to face felony charges.
Wow.
Isn't that fascinating?
Given what I've read about my topic, I'm surprised.
Well, you know, just because you did it didn't mean you got charged with it. So this story was so bizarre that it became national news.
National news.
It put Oflin and Shipman's relationship into the national spotlight. Of course, that put a strain on their relationship. And, like, everybody involved.
She's just like, dude, I just want to go to dinner.
Yeah. And, like, Oflin, Shipman, Nowak, they all became, like, punchlines on late night talk shows.
Oh, yeah.
But, anyway, Shipman said after the attack, she thought, I'm going to be okay, but it was never okay after that. So some people close to Lisa speculated that the Columbia shuttle disaster might have played a part in her breakdown. So that was...
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's what she does for a living. Uh-huh. She's got small children.
So that happened on February 1st, 2003. The Space Shuttle Columbia was returning to Earth, and it was completely destroyed after a piece of foam broke off and hit the ship's wing. 7 astronauts on board lost their life, and one of them was Lisa's close friend, Laurel Clark.
Ah.
Also, it's well known that astronauts have... face rigorous screening, but Lisa Nowak's last battery of psychological tests were back in 1996. So in addition to that, she would have known that if she was trying to seek treatment for any like mental health problems, it would have meant that she would probably lose her place in the space program.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't have wanted to jeopardize the chances of going to space. And so that would have given her an incentive to hide any mental health issues she might be facing. Oh, for sure.
Or any health issues. There's a bit of that in my story as well.
And it's also possible that when she returned from her 2006 space flight, that affected her state of mind, because she knew after that would probably be her only mission, and that she also did have some trouble readjusting.
Yeah.
And I guess that's normal.
Did she go to the space station?
I didn't look up what her mission was.
Okay.
Because I'm not a space nerd, so I didn't care.
Right. But the space mission, the station thing, I understand. Because you're, you know, isolated and way up there. And it would freak me out, man.
Yeah.
Like, if I broke my leg, I can't get home. If something happens to my child, I can't get home.
Yeah. So Oflin had a hard time as well. He was perceived in the press as a philanderer, even though his relationship with Lisa started after he had already separated from his wife, right. And his relationship with Shipman was after he had ended his relationship with Lisa.
But he gets painted in the bad light.
Yep. So in 2008, Lisa and her husband Richard divorced. Moving forward, the trial's about to start. Lisa and her attorneys file paperwork for an insanity plea. They claimed that she suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder, you think? And also insomnia and depression. And then during...
Insomnia can do some crazy shit.
Oh, for sure. For sure. That's what I was thinking when I read this piece. Also in a court ruling... they ruled that Lisa had not been fully advised of her rights, and therefore her police interview was inadmissible.
They probably couldn't advise her of her rights because she just kept saying she wanted to talk to him.
No, that's all she wanted to do. To the girlfriend.
To the girl.
Yeah.
But she was focused.
Yes. So in 2009, Lisa pled guilty to a reduced charge of burglary and misdemeanor battery. During court, she said that she was sincerely sorry for her actions, and she promised that she would never contact Oflin again. She was given a year of probation. She was also required to write a letter of apology to Shipman. Shipman was not happy with the sentence. She told the court that Nowak had intended to kill her. She said it was in her eyes, a blood-chilling expression of limitless rage and glee. So after the attack, Shipman lost a lot of weight. She also suffered with nightmares. She had dizzy spells.
She got sprayed in the face with pepper spray.
Yeah.
I mean, that's bad. But really?
Well, and then I think to me, in my mind, the worst of it would have been the media coverage.
Yes. That I can totally see. Yeah. Messing you up.
Let's see. Ch-ch-ch. Oh. In 2010, Lisa received an other than honorable discharge from the Navy.
Oh, I like that wording. Other than honorable.
Yeah. She now lives in Texas. She works in the private sector. She does not give interviews, but her attorney told People magazine that Lisa's in a better place. Oflin,
does she get to see her kids?
I think so, yeah. Oflin and Shipman married in 2010. They live in Alaska. They have a son. And NASA, after all this, now instituted annual psychological screenings for their astronauts.
Oh, they check them every year. That's a good idea.
Yes. So I looked at Wikipedia, as always, biography.com, people.com, and Ranker.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so I'm just pre-warning you, my drink, my story... I thought it would be a good idea to do this story, and then I got into it, and it's massive. And per the usual, I over-researched, and then I went through and tried to edit. But I'm going to attempt to edit on the fly because I have to. It's too much.
It's too much.
It's too much. But I could have done a seven-part series.
I would run out of astronaut crime stories if we did that.
Okay, so I thought about so many things covered with this drink. At first, I thought, well, let's do the Challenger explosion because I don't know about you. I was in the sixth grade. I remember every minute of that entire day. That happened on January 26th, 1986. Then I thought about doing the Columbia explosion because that took place on what turned out to be my grandmother's last birthday. And I remember it because it was her birthday, but then being that it was her last birthday, I guess I kind of remember it more. I don't know. But anyway, I remembered that I was slightly obsessed with this TV show. It was a very short-lived TV show from 2015 called The Astronauts Wives Club.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that show.
Yes. And it was all about the women who were married to the Mercury 7.
That seems like... I was getting an image. My cousin, her husband was an officer in the Air Force. And She would talk about... when she was at this particular Air Force base on the other side of the country, how like the wives were just like this particular like clique. And
yeah.
She didn't like it.
And oh, I'm interesting.
Kind of getting vibes of that right now.
Interesting. Well, the Astronauts Wives Club was this beautiful show. It was just, I watched it for the clothes. And it was the same time period as that show about the United Airlines stewardesses. Don't remember what it was called. Maybe it wasn't United Airlines. Maybe it was Delta. I don't know. But anyway, there was this rash of shows from the 60s with gorgeous clothes. Maisel is along those lines. Anyway, so I decided to do the Mercury 7. And then I found out that I could have done...
the Mercury 1.
The Mercury 1. Yeah, like I said. So I'm going to try to just edit as I go and just scratch the surface. But there's a few that are so cool. So I have to tell the whole story. So anyway... President Eisenhower decided that we needed to go to space. We needed to go to space not only for scientific advancement, but as you and I know of growing up during the Cold War, we needed to go to space to beat the Russians.
We must.
So President Eisenhower decides he's going to go to space, and he decides that we need to go to space, and the people who are going to space need to be from the military. So that really, really narrows the field. They originally screened 508 service records in 1959.
Okay, so I'm going to have to continue watching, but on Disney Plus, there's that show that...
Yes. I want to see that now that I heard about it.
I watched like maybe like the first two episodes, and that's all what it was, is them screening the records and then like featuring picking particular people that did actually get picked.
Ooh, interesting. Okay. So they screened these 508 people in January of 1959. Of those 508, they only narrowed it down to 110. So now they've got 110 people. They want six. They've got 110. In this list of 110, there's 5 Marines, 47 Navy. Go Navy. I'm a Navy brat. I can say that. 58 Air Force pilots and Army pilots were screened, but there was not one that had graduated test pilot school.
I didn't even know there was Army pilots.
Apparently there's Army pilots, but they're not graduating test pilot school for some reason.
Maybe they never went to test pilot school.
They could not have done that. But anyway, so we've got this 110.
They're not really known for their pilots.
They're not known for their pilots. I think it's kind of weird, though, that the Navy and the Marines are known for their pilots because, hi, Navy.
Well, the Navy has aircraft carriers.
They do. But how is that not connected? Why didn't they put the two expertise together? Why do we have two branches of the military, three branches of the military, that are all experts at flying?
Well, because an Air Force pilot cannot land on an aircraft carrier.
Why can't we teach him to do that?
They can't. They're not capable. My dad is a former Navy aviator, so I can tell you right then and there, there are two different people.
But they should have just taught them to do that. My dad was the little nerd down in the communications bay typing on the computer.
Well, does he want to teach an airman to land on a postage stamp?
No, I don't think he does.
There you go.
Yeah, there's an episode we could do about our dads during the war. But anyway, so 110 folks. Now they have to figure this out. So they break this, and this reminded me of a job interview that I did not get once because of this same practice. So they take these 110 and they divide them into three groups. And the first group, they bring them in to interview and they're like, wow, out of 35, we like 24 of them.
Oh gosh.
I know. And so then they bring in the second group and they do the same with them and they like a bunch of them. So now we've got 56. 69 people came and we've got 56 that we like and have passed all of these tests. And we still have a whole other group of people. So you know what they did with that whole other group of people?
Dumped them.
They dumped them. That happened to me at a job interview. This principal had 18 resumes. He counted out 9, put those in a pile, said, interview those. We'll interview these next week.
And next week never happened.
Next week never happened because they found what they wanted in the first week. And I was in the second pile and I was pissed. Anyway, so now we're down to 56. So then they take these and they end up with, they start bringing them in and saying, do you want to come for the interview, blah, blah. They end up with 36. So these 36 are invited to come in and they are put through the rigor. Like, they are given physical examinations. They are, now we have 32. After the physical exams, we have 32. They then are going to go through mental and physical environmental tests and different things. And they only eliminate one.
Wow.
With all of that.
That's hard to imagine.
Because they have the top of the top of the top of the top. They have like the one half of the top one half of the 1% at this point. And so we've got, now they're doing 30 different laboratory tests. They're testing chemical. They're doing a bunch of tests. I just looked at that word and after half a drink, I'm not reading it. They did x-rays. They mapped each man's body. They did psychological examinations. They did this Socratic questioning where they said, who are you? And in this who are you question, they had to rank 20 things that they were in order of importance.
That'd be hard just to keep track of.
Yes. And then they had to say, if you were head of the mission, who would you want to go with you? Out of the 5 people that you're grouped with going through this test, who do you want to go with you? You can't go. Who do you want to go instead of you?
That's interesting. I kind of like that.
Like really deep, deep, deep psychological tests. So they're done. They finally get down to this next group. And there's 18.
Okay. That's 3 times more than they needed.
They want 6. So they...
Wait, didn't you say it was the 7?
We'll get to that. So they sit down and they're like, okay. So they look at everything. They start looking at their service records. They start looking at their experience. What have they flown? What have they done? And I'm just going to pour the rest in since you just poured the rest in.
Yeah, I didn't pour that much.
I did. I like this drink. Although it's kind of giving me heartburn a little bit.
It's got a lot of lemon juice.
Yeah. It's also got a lot of booze because...
Well, it only has 2 ounces of booze.
I know, but...
That's like only a little more than a shot.
Maybe it's because I haven't eaten anything today. I don't know.
Probably
I'm
that.
I'm just having a hard time reading the words on the page that I have to edit in my brain. So we've got... now we've got these 18 people, and they're researching extensively. And they're trying to get down to 6, and they're like, we can't. We have 7. They finally said, sorry, Mr. President, we have 7. And the president said, okay, we have 7.
All right, 7 it is.
7 it is. So...
I kind of like 7 better anyway.
They were introduced in this big press conference, which is where the term astronaut was coined. And here are the 7. Now, as I said, I'm going to try and edit in my brain as I read, because I don't think any of you are interested in hearing me recite this 22-page
document. So she's going to leave out, like, marriages, awards, classes they've taken, etc.
Dude, I also talked about their deaths and what happened to their ashes after they died.
We don't care.
If you've listened to Crime and Time on the Rocks for a while, you notice that I have a problem with...
tersity.
Yes. I want you to know everything there is to know about my topic.
I have the opposite problem.
If I'm telling you about a topic, I want you to be an expert at it by the end, even though I am not. I am a drunk. So my first person is Donald Deke Slayton. And Deke was born on March 1st, 1924 in Sparta, Wisconsin.
A Pisces.
I'm not going to tell you who to, even though I had that.
For the 3rd of 6 siblings.
I had that too. I like to research. Anyway, he graduated from Sparta High School in Wisconsin in 1942, and he went straight to the Army Air Corps on his 18th birthday.
Let's just stipulate they all graduated from high school.
But some of it's interesting.
They're military officers. They all graduated from high school.
Okay, he enlisted on his 18th birthday.
That's cute.
He went to Europe and he flew 56 combat missions with the 340th Bombardment Group. And then he came home in 1944. And in 1945, he went to Japan with the 319th Bombardment Group and flew 7 combat missions in Japan. He was working as an instructor pilot when they called him for this. He was stationed in Germany for a little while. He met his wife. They got married. They came home. That's like 3 paragraphs that I skipped over.
Oh, wow.
So he attends the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, and he does very well, and he's eventually chosen to fly. He makes it to the Mercury 7. He's eventually chosen to fly an orbital mission on the Mercury Atlas 7. They got to name their own missions.
That's cool.
Which is super cool. So he named his he intended to name his Delta 7, but when they were testing him, they found a slight problem with his heart.
Aww.
Yes, it's very, very sad. So they find a slight problem with his heart, and he is scrapped. So now he's trying to improve his health. He does all of the things that you do. He quit smoking. He quit drinking coffee. He started exercising more.
Eating oatmeal.
And he cut back on alcohol, because it is the 1960s.
So only like 8 martinis a day.
Oh my god, I can't stop laughing. So he's really, really working hard. They found out that there was an operation they could do, and NASA told him he was not allowed to do it because of the risks. Because he's doing other stuff behind the scenes. He's really an asset to them behind the scenes.
So he couldn't do the surgery no matter what to stay in NASA, even if he wasn't...
No, he couldn't do the surgery to become a... astronaut.
Okay.
He was still working for NASA.
Okay.
He did this, I believe it was him, I had to cut it out. But one of them did a whole bunch of things in test pilot school where he ended up saving the Air Force like hundreds of thousands of dollars because he fixed a bug.
Fantastic.
And I think it was him.
That's like one toilet seat nowadays in government.
Oh my God, I don't want to talk about that. The toilet seats are cheap, people. So anyway, he's still going on. He eventually gets returned. He's doing everything he can to get returned to flight status. He is not returned to flight status until 1970. So he's part of the Mercury 7, but he does not get to go up in the original thing.
Aw, sad.
No. But on February 9th, 1973, he's assigned to the Apollo Suez test project along with Thomas Stratford. And this is the first mission where they're going to rendezvous with another group of people. So he has to learn Russian.
Oh, wow.
In order to do this.
Da.
So he takes his space flight on July 15th, 1975. It is launched from the Apollo Docking Module Pilot Station. It is the first meeting in space between American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts. And they rendezvoused and docked over Europe. They were together for 44 hours. And the major obstacles of the mission were accomplished. Everything was great. And it returned to Earth on July 24th, 1975. He died of a malignant brain tumor in 1992. There's a whole paragraph about his marriages. But I skipped it.
Marriage stuff. Got it.
I just feel like these people are so fascinating and you're not learning all the things you should learn about them.
But like, okay, we're here for a mission. We're not here to find out like that they graduated from high school. Their wife, Joan, was a homemaker until she started a small business.
There's this really cute story about John Glenn delivering newspapers.
So we were joking earlier when you told me how long it was. And I was like, well, why don't you just like focus on one or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then we came to the idea where you would tell your story first and then you would end it with, and John Glenn.
Because even though I've severely abbreviated his story, John Glenn is amazing. Was amazing. It was wonderful. All right, so now I'm going to tell you about Gordon Cooper Jr., L. Gordon Cooper Jr. So he was born in 1927 in Oklahoma. He went into the military.
After high school.
He received a commission. No. Okay, this is interesting. I think it's interesting. So he wanted to go. Yes, there's a cat.
He's happy boy.
The Army-Navy flight school was not. This reminded me of a kid that I went to high school with. So the Army-Navy flight school wasn't taking people. So he said, I'll join the Marines. So I went to high school with this kid, and during junior high, I called him every night at 5 o'clock on Friday. I don't know why, because I was a nerd.
Well, yeah.
But he found me years later, and he told me the story about how he had intended to join the Army, and the Army office was closed when he went, so he went to the Air Force, because they were open.
That might have been a good choice.
It was. He retired. His son went to the Air Force. It was a whole big thing. But anyway, this reminded me of that. So he is now in the Navy. However, Army-Navy is not...
He's in the Marines.
Yeah, so he's in the Marines. So he's in the Marines, but he gets a commission from the Army ROTC during college, but he gets to go to flight school. So he's in flight school, blah, blah, blah. He has been home for a little while. He's out of the military. He's doing his thing. And he hears this announcement about the space capsule. And he's like, ooh, that seems kind of interesting. So he gets back involved. Oh my God, stop. See, I can't edit on the fly with this after this many two cocktails. So he's in the Army ROTC. He ends up going out of the military, goes back, but he stays in the... He goes to the Air Force Reserves, but he's working, so he's doing his, like, life. And the Air Force Reserves calls him back to full-time duty. When he's in full-time duty with them in Minnesota, even though he was working in Seattle at Lockheed, which he made me cut out, he he hears about this other program, the space program, and he's like, hey,
that's for me.
That's for me. So he ends up being chosen and because of his record, and he gets called to Washington, D.C. for a briefing. He's doing all the tests, blah, blah, blah. He comes home from the tests, tells his boss, you need to start looking for somebody else.
I'm going to space.
He tells his wife and his family, you need to start packing our shit. We're moving. He was one of, what, 30-something?
Mm-hmm.
But just a few days after he's home, he gets the call.
When you know, you know.
You want to go to space? Yeah. So when you know, you know. And so the serviceman on the phone was like, when can you be here? And he's like, I'm now good?
Driving right now.
Yeah. He literally says, quote, how about now? So his first flight was in on May 15th, 1963. He was the pilot of the MA-9, which was the last Mercury mission. His Faith 7 capsule orbited Earth 22 times, logged more time in space than the previous 5 Mercury missions combined. His primary objective was to determine whether or not people could stay in space long term. He was the first astronaut to sleep in orbit. He was also the last astronaut to fly alone in space.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. He ended up later becoming, 2 years later, he's the commander of the Gemini GT-5 with Charles Pete Conrad. And this mission went on to prove that astronauts could survive in space for the time that it took a spacecraft to get to Earth, from Earth to the moon and back, because we're prepping for stuff. So this mission was 7 days, 22 hours, 55 minutes, and 14 seconds. They did 120 orbits, and he all came back. He is the one who designed the patches. So they all have a patch that they wear for their mission that they wear over on the other side of it's worn on the right breast. And the original patch that he designed said 8 days or bust, but he had this really stick-in-the-mud commander who not only would not let him name the capsule after the First Lady because he didn't want to personalize the missions, but he also made him remove the 8 days or bust from the insignia, from the patch, because he wanted the stick-in-the-mud politician wanted the focus of the mission to be on the science, and he didn't want the public to be disappointed if it didn't last the full 8 days.
That actually kind of makes sense.
I guess, but how many people are looking at a patch on their right breast that closely?
Well, back then, everybody.
That's true. It was a big deal. So he did a great job. He, however, had some other interesting things with his life. When he was in space, this I thought was cool just from a history aspect. When he was in space, he was flying over Bermuda and he saw blue water, but he saw some dark spots in the blue water and he wondered if those were not shipwrecks.
Could be.
But
Bermuda
no one ever.
Triangle.
Yes, but no one ever took him seriously enough to check. And part of that may have been because he also claimed to have seen UFOs over West Germany in 1951.
Well, that also could be.
Yes. He didn't talk about it during his Mercury testing. But on May 3rd, 1957, when Cooper was at Edwards, he had a crew were set up at the place.
At a place.
At a place. That's, you know, there's a lot of vowels, and it's about this long. But it was a dry lake bed. They had a system that would take pictures of one frame per second, and they started work at the site before 8 o'clock. They looked at the motion picture cameras, and according to Cooper's accounts, they all came back, all of the people that were working there came back, and they had seen strange looking saucer like aircraft that didn't make a sound when they were landing or taking off. He said that the men that he was speaking with saw experimental aircraft on a regular basis, was part of their job, but this one creeped them out. They said the saucer hovered over them, landed 50 yards away, used 3 extending landing gears, and then took off as they walked nearer to get a closer look. He called a special Pentagon number that was used to report these incidents. He was instructed to send the film over in a locked courier pouch. But nobody told him that he couldn't look at the negatives before he sent the film. So he did. And when he looked at the negatives, he saw that the photograph quality was excellent, that he saw exactly what his two soldiers had described to them. But there was never any follow-up investigation. He never heard about anything again. Sent the film off, and that was it. It went away. And he talked about this extensively later in his career. He didn't find it in space, but he found it when he was here. But anyway, so the next one is Walter Marty Shira Jr. He was born in 1923 in Hackensack, New Jersey. He graduated from Dwight W. Morrow High School and went on to the Naval Academy. He was a bomber in World War II. He was a bomber in Korea. He flew various types of aircraft for the Navy. And he was working for at a river when he heard about the Mercury project. He was very, very interested in that. He tested for a position as an astronaut, and they discovered a polyp on his larynx.
Uh-oh.
Yes. So the doctors said, well, let's fix this. You have to be silent for 6 days. But he's got this big career. He's like head of all of these different things, these different places
river
in the Navy.
Things.
Yes, river things and Navy things and things. So he's trying to figure this out. And then he also was scheduled to take a psychological test. So he's like,
I have to talk to this.
I have to talk to you. I can't talk. So finally, they were able to schedule a time when he didn't have to talk. And while he's on his complete silence, he got a call from a NASA official to say, hey, how's the polyp coming?
Idiot.
So he had to talk.
Why didn't they send a courier?
I don't know. But eventually they decided, let's just fucking operate. So they operated, and what should have been a 2 or 3 month treatment plan was abbreviated to a 2 or 3 day treatment.
I was going to say, you're going to say day.
Yes. So he was like, okay, this is serious. They want me. So at 7:15 on October 3rd, 1962, he went on his first Mercury flight. It was named the Sigma 7. He demonstrated great positioning. He was able to maneuver things and get everything right. He's having some trouble, though. So he gets up there and he sees that things are not working great. He has to... The automatic controls that are supposed to take place are not taking place.
So everything's manual.
Yes, which it's not supposed to be.
Not supposed to be.
His suit gets up to 90 degrees. And he finally says, switching this to manual. So that was kind of like the way of the mission. This isn't working. Finally, switching it to manual. So he makes 6 orbits. He finally manually aligns his spacecraft over Africa to perform his retrofire to come back in. He is 5 miles from the recovery ship when he finally lands. So here it is. Everything is just a mess. He's had to do all this manually, and he ends up 5 miles from where he's supposed to be.
That's fantastic.
He's a badass.
Yeah. I need to use my GPS to get to like downtown Sacramento.
He's a badass. And he's in space doing things by himself manually and gets 5 miles of where he's supposed to be. He takes a second mission in 1965. He takes a third mission in 1968. He was the commander of the Apollo 7. On the Apollo 7, he gets a cold.
Uh-oh.
He proceeds to give it to the other 3 astronauts, which kind of sucks. So their nasal passages are so full, and because there's no gravity, they're not draining. Because as your nasal passages fill, gravity filters it towards your nose to come out.
So what did they do?
Well, the only relief they had was to blow their nose, which is not a problem until it comes to reentry. And during reentry, I mean, it hurts. They blow their nose and the eardrums pop, which, you know, you experience that when you're in an airplane. But when it comes to reentry, they have to put their helmets on.
Uh-oh.
You can't blow your nose in a helmet. So here is a big commercial. If you would like to sponsor us, do so. They each took an Actifed.
Remember Actifed?
Yes. Actifed, Sudafed, all the decongestants. I'm a big fan because I have horrible sinuses. You can sponsor us. They each took an Actifed an hour before they had to reenter. Everything was fine. Some mild pain, but they all made it perfectly fine.
Space decongestant.
Actifed. My next astronaut is Malcolm Scott Carpenter. He was born in 1925 in Boulder, Colorado. He had kind of a sad early life. His parents separated when he was three, and then mom ended up in the hospital with TB, consumption for history nerds. And he ends up being raised by a family friend. However, he's amazing. And so he ends up, after the war, he went to the University of Colorado and majored in aeronautical engineering. He received his degree in 1949. He becomes one of the original Mercury 7, obviously. And he is on May 24th, 1962, he goes up in his mission, which is dubbed the Aurora 7. He is on top of a Mercury Atlas 7 rocket. Remember when they had the like little capsule and it was on top of the rocket? The shuttle. The shuttle was very small. It looked like a little weird looking plane with these like three things underneath. At this point, they had a tiny little capsule that looked sort of like a...
On the tip of the rocket, right?
On the tip of a huge rocket. And this huge rocket would propel them up. And then once they got in orbit, it would fall away. So he's in that, obviously. The goal in this mission was a stepping stone for lunar landing. So what they were trying to do was see what colors could be seen in space, what you could do in space. So he has a balloon that he is supposed to deploy at a certain point. This is like what he needs to do. The balloon doesn't work. It finally goes off, but it won't go the full distance. It's only 10 inches wide instead of 30, so it's much smaller.
Way smaller.
Yes, but he says, hey, I can see the color orange, I think it is. But so he tells them that he can see this color, which was the main point. He ends up, this balloon deploys and it does not disengage. So he drags this balloon with him all the way back into reentry.
Oh my gosh, how funny is that?
It was a thing. So it continued all the way into reentry. And he's, again, having to do this, like, manual thing because things are not working. And it's not good. It throws everything off. So at the time he's coming back in, he thinks that everything is fine. But he's off by 25 degrees.
That's a lot.
So they have to line up the top of the thing, the capsule, with something. And he thinks he's fine, but he's off by 25 degrees because this freaking balloon is dragging behind him, flopping in the wind in space. So it's not pointed in the straight axis. So this is 170 miles.
Wow, off. The other guy did the whole freaking thing manually, and he was only 5 miles off.
Yes, oh, this gets worse. So then a lot of other things happen. The retro rockets don't deploy. He sees that they don't deploy. He reacts. He pushes manual deploy. That took 3 seconds. That 3 seconds cost him another 60 miles.
Oh, my God. Now we're over 200 miles.
Yes. So now he's going through things, and then the speed with which he's going because of the balloon puts him off another 15 miles. He ends up 250 miles off from where he is supposed to be.
That's extensive.
Yes. There was a big thing with fuel, and he was supposed to have more fuel, but the fuel was like running out because he pulled this lever or something with the, like, there was an automatic tank, and it was...
Well, plus he's dragging a balloon the whole way.
Yes, he's dragging a balloon the whole way. So he finally gets, he sees the horizon. He's manually maneuvering this to try and use as little fuel as possible. He's got his position. Then the oscillations start, which tells him, okay, I'm in heavy atmosphere. So his capsule is rolling 10 degrees a second.
Oh,
I don't
gosh.
Know how fast that is, but it doesn't sound
pleasant. I just don't like the idea
no matter
of rolling.
How fast it is.
Yeah.
So it does not sound fun. So he's very concerned about the heat. So he does a thing. He sets it rolling further to keep the heat distributing. So he did that on purpose.
I don't know what that means. But...
okay, so he's coming in and it's going to get hot where the atmosphere is creating
the
most drag.
Yeah, I'm picturing a rotisserie. I get that.
So he starts it rolling.
I don't see why going faster is going to help.
No, the rolling is going to help. So he made it start rolling.
Oh, okay. I thought it was already rolling and then he was like, let me roll a little faster. I'm like, I don't see how that's going to help.
So he starts it rolling. So it's heating evenly.
Yeah.
So he'll cook evenly.
Instead of barbecuing, he's rotisserieing.
Yes, he's going to be crispy on all sides.
Got it. Because I was like, I don't know how going faster would help.
No. So ironically, the ride was mostly smooth. He is heading down at a good angle. He glances out the window and he sees this orange ring of fiery particles that are just kind of going off of the spacecraft. And that's the heat shield melting off of
that doesn't sound
spacecraft.
Good.
He's like, eh.
I'm no astronaut, but I feel like I would preserve my heat shield as much as possible.
I might want to panic, yes. So now he's starting to feel all of this inside. And he's very concerned. The G forces tapered off at 120,000 feet. And the capsule is starting to, now he's falling 600 miles per hour.
Not scary.
No. He's hoping he lands in an ocean. He's worried about the parachute. He is concerned that if he deploys it too early, it's going to like snap the capsule around and cause all kinds of problems. So he presses the button to deploy it at 26,000 feet. It's supposed to be deployed at 21,000 feet, but he couldn't wait any longer. So the initial parachute comes out fine, and that dampens kind of his oscillations. It slows him a little bit. Then the altimeter swings towards 10,000 feet, and that's when the main chute is supposed to come out, but it didn't.
Uh-oh.
So he goes 500 more feet before he pulls the manual lever. So this is two astronauts now that have had to completely do their mission
manually. Yeah.
I would be concerned. But anyway, so he pulls the ripcord and it comes out fine. Everything's great. It's struggling, but it's making it. He overshoots his target area by 250 miles. He gets... he makes it. He's there. He's hanging out. He's the tracking devices, which computated his landing point on his descent, are not working because he's so far out of range. Most of NASA's communication between the capsule and the ground were made on a line of sight basis. And as long as the capsule was in the orbital altitude, the radio transmissions could be carried out fine. But the capsule was not. And so he reached the parachute level at 2,000 feet, and there was no one was close enough to hear him. He finally was able to pick up some ground transmissions, and he didn't receive an answer, so he had no idea. So he's hanging out, floating in the ocean for 4 hours, 53 minutes. No, strike that. He lands. Oh my God, I don't understand space shit. So... upon landing, after 4 hours, 53 minutes, and 47 seconds of flight, the capsule becomes completely submerged.
Yikes.
And is listing 60 degrees to the side. He's starting to see water come into the capsule, so he's getting a little concerned. He sees the tape recorder at his feet's got water on it. So he's like, okay, I'm going to get out. So he's going to get out and wait on the raft. So he takes his helmet off. He removes the instrument panel so that he can make his way to the exit.
I'm just saying, but once you're already floating around, wouldn't you have taken your helmet off to begin with?
No, he's a good spaceman.
But you're not in space anymore.
I don't know! He left it on because he follows orders.
That's just weird.
Okay. Anyway, he opens a hatch at the end of the craft and he puts his camera in a safe place, and then he drops onto the life raft that he sees, that he deployed. But he landed on the life raft. The life raft fell into the ocean upside down. So he gets into the water. He flips the life raft over, and he gets back in the life raft. And now he's hanging there. He's 1,000 miles southeast of the Cape. And he's finally, people are coming. So the Intrepid begins approaching. He signals them with the hand mirror that he has. The planes are all around him now. Two paramedics jump in the ocean and attach a collar to the capsule so it doesn't sink.
Well, yeah.
Because that's what the paramedics are going to do first.
Need to save that.
When the paramedics get him out, he says, "Hi, are you fellas hungry? Would you like some food?" So they end up, it takes an hour and a half, but they get him back to where he's supposed to be, and they get him to, he offers them food. Okay. So he finally gets home. He's in the Grand Turk Island for debriefing, and he's faced with honor ceremonies, all these things. And then he's also faced with being told, your performance in this mission has assured that you will never partake in another mission.
It is a little unsatisfactory.
But he didn't die.
That's not the point.
It was bad. So he just switches gear and he starts to explore the ocean. He becomes one part of the U.S. Navy's Sea Lab 2 project in 1965. And he is known for being the only man who is both an astronaut and an aquanaut.
That's pretty cool.
It's pretty darn cool, yes. Now we will move on to Mr. John Glenn.
And John Glenn.
Oh my God, John Glenn. I feel like I just need to abbreviate him into like three sentences so we can talk about him some more. John Glenn is the shit. John Glenn is just the shit. That's all I have to say. He was born in 1921. He was amazing in World War II.
Did he go to high school?
Yes. He was amazing in Korea. He married his wife, Anna. They were married for 74 years. They only had 2 kids. He was the backup astronaut for both Shepard and Grissom. He finally gets to go to space on February 20th, 1962. He also has to manually control things because I think they need to fix that shit.
Yeah, I'm like, that's number 3 now.
Oh, we're not done. And so he's, you know, having to do this. Another problem that Glenn encountered involved a signal sent to the ground via telemetry indicating that his spacecraft, the Friendship 7, had a loose heat shield. And in order to make sure it was secured in place during reentry, the retropack was kept in place to steady the shield. During reentry, okay. Portions of the burning retropack flew by the window.
First of all, I don't understand what a heat shield is, because when I hear that, I think of like a force field or something, but clearly it's an actual object.
It's an actual object that is burning off and flying by his window as he's driving.
I'm not a space person, but if you tell me my heat shield's flying by me, I'm going to get concerned.
This is what, number 3 that the heat shield has flown by?
Yeah.
I think we should stop doing this.
Especially when the Columbia crashes because of a piece of foam.
Yes. So, John Glenn does all this shit. He's amazing. He ran for Senate, but then he fell and hit his head, so he couldn't run for Senate, but he ended up becoming the senator anyway.
Is he the one that socked someone in the face?
No, he fell and hit his head in a bathtub.
No. Is like one of the astronauts, like the old-timey astronauts, like socked somebody in the face as when they were an older man for saying something to them.
I would not be surprised. John Glenn has a career. We need to do just an episode on John Glenn because he first said that women shouldn't go to space in the 60s. I don't know why they asked him that. And then he supports the career of a woman in space. He become he tries to become he's running for vice president. He tries to run for president. He runs for senator. He was a senator. He was the only person in Ohio elected for four consecutive terms.
Wow.
He's kind of the shit.
Maybe we will do an episode on him someday.
We should. So he had gone to space. And then you'll just be like,
Mercury 7, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So he had gone to space earlier, had to do all this manual stuff. And then on January 16th, 1998, NASA administrator Dan Golden says, "We appointed John Glenn as a member of the Space Shuttle Discovery."
What?
He's 77 years
nah,
old.
Nah, bro. I mean, I know they sent a civilian into space, but a 77-year-old?
Yes. So he is scheduled for a flight on October 29th, 1998. He served as a payload specialist and subject for research on the weightlessness on the effects of the body of an older person. They did all kinds of blood tests on him. They were trying to determine what, basically, they were trying to determine what caused muscle atrophy in older people. And they did it by sending a 77-year-old badass to space.
Right? And that makes no sense, first of all.
I think it's freaking cool.
It just doesn't make sense to me. Okay, I'm not a scientist.
He's 77 and he's in space.
I'm clearly not a scientist. However, that doesn't seem like a valid experiment because muscle atrophy in older people are because they become way less active.
Yes, but they're trying to figure out how to combat that without making them more active.
And then you send a badass who's not a typical average
not a typical older
77-year-old
person.
Into space to do this experiment. Nah.
He is not a typical 77-year-old.
You need to send in, like, a series of grandmas to discover that.
Like my mom.
Not
who
John
sits
Glenn.
On the couch all the time. Yeah. So, anyway, John Glenn, badass. He died in 2016. I might talk about him if we ever have another space drink. My next person is Virgil Gus Grissom. He was born in 1926. He married Betty Moore, and I'm talking about how he married Betty Moore because he met Betty Moore his sophomore year in high school. During World War II, during gas rationing, he would save his gas and take her out for driving lessons.
Oh, that's cute.
He loved her so much.
Okay, you're allowed to keep that one in.
Thank you.
Did he go to high school?
Yes. Obviously, he met Betty Moore. He went to Korea. He kicked ass. He did all kinds of stuff. He really was very private. In fact, after he became an astronaut, he built a house in Texas so that he could be near the Cape Canaveral. I don't think it was called that then. Or maybe it was Canaveral then.
It was Canaveral, and then it turned Kennedy.
Anyway, he built a house near there. He purposely did not put any windows in the front of the house because he didn't want people to stare in from the street.
That's smart.
Yes. So, loved Betty. Super duper family man. He had a lot of problems with his first re-entry. I'm going to abbreviate it because we're already way over time and people are bored. You're already turning us off. He did, however, feel like that he had wandered into a James Bond movie when they called him because he received a phone call from Washington, D.C., or he received a phone call and it said, "Come to Washington, D.C., dressed in civilian clothes. This is a top secret mission."
Okay, I remember that from that Disney show. You should watch that. You have the Disney,
I'm gonna watch,
right?
That. Yes, I do.
Yeah, you guys should watch that.
We might start that tonight.
I'm gonna have to continue to watch it.
Yeah, we might start that tonight. So he's like, what the hell? But he loves it. He's instantly in. He's like, yeah, this. But he says, "I didn't like my performance on the physical tests. I think I could have done better."
That's a specimen for you.
Yes. He is the shit. So every now and again, though, and this tells you something, too, about where his priorities are. Here's a quote. "After I made the grade, I would lie in bed once in a while at night and think about the capsule and the booster." Remember the big ball of fire underneath them. "And ask myself, why in the hell do you want to get up there in that thing?" I wondered especially when I thought about Betty and the two boys. But I knew the answer. We all like to be respected in our fields. And this is his field. So, he makes his first mission, which is called the Liberty Bell, it had a little bit of issues. It was first postponed. And then he finally gets to go up. Everything is a smooth liftoff. They made some changes. He now had a picture window. Picture window on a space capsule. Okay. But he had a panoramic view of space. It was beautiful.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yes. Everything is great. Everything worked fine.
What about the heat shield?
Apparently it worked fine at that point.
Oh, good.
It's attained splashdown. He opened the faceplate of his helmet to disconnect his oxygen hose, unfastened his helmet from his suit, released his chest strap, his lap strap, his shoulder harness, his knee straps, and his medical sensors, and he rolled down the neck dam of his suit, and then he prepared to snap the hatch. So he does that. He's recovered by helicopter. Everything is fine. Perfectly wonderful. The hatch blows. It's all great.
But that's a lot of straps to undo.
It's a lot of freaking straps. So he turned his attention to preparing the hatch for egress by completing the standard procedures for arming the detonator. So he goes through all of this stuff. He notifies the recovery helicopter called the Hunt Club, and he maneuvers another few switches. And then his final transmission to the helicopter was, as soon as I finished looking things over, I told Hunt Club I was ready. According to the plan, the pilot was to inform me as soon as he had lifted me a bit so that the capsule would not ship water when the hatch blew. So he removes his helmet, he blows his hatch, and he gets out. He's lying there waiting to receive final confirmation for him to blow the hatch, and he's waiting, and then suddenly, boom, hatch blows off, and he's like, what the fuck? I didn't touch anything. It just blew off. Well, because it blew off before it got there, water starts flooding in. It ends up that the Liberty sinks.
Oh, sad.
He's devastated. This is the only thing that he's ever lost. They were able to save him, obviously, but it was a big question. And the press was just very like, what the heck? Why didn't you follow protocol? He's like, I freaking did. And one of the other astronauts that I mentioned earlier that I had to edit out, a similar circumstance happened to him. And so it was able to prove that Grissom did nothing wrong. But he was really, really villainized by the press for losing this capsule.
He didn't do that.
But they had no way to prove that. It was like he was literally in there by himself.
Yeah.
So they did all kinds of tests. They had him flail around inside a capsule. They had him push all these buttons. And he's like, nothing happened. Nothing made this blow up by itself. It was a fluke. But nobody believed him. But finally, it's like, okay. And they end up forgiving him. He's sad. He's really struggling with this. It's a big thing to get him off. There was three helicopters to get him out. They finally get him up safely. And President Kennedy telephones him immediately and says, I'm glad you're safe. And that's all there is to it. But the press just attacks him when he gets hurt.
Savage vultures.
Even in the 1960s, they just attack him. Why couldn't you save this? Blah, 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 blah. And at one point, one of them asked him, were you ever scared? He says, well, yeah. The headline read, astronaut admits to being afraid. So he said.
No.
So that is when he built the house with the wall with no windows.
If they would have said, were you ever scared? I would have said, were you ever brave?
That's an amazing line. That is an amazing line. So he ends up being chosen for another mission. The name of this one cracked me up. So they were toying with the name between Molly Brown, after the unsinkable Molly Brown.
But his thing sank, so that right. sucks.
Well, that's why they wanted to name it this one Molly Brown, or the Titanic. And he's like, we're fucking calling it Molly Brown. I'm not calling it the Titanic.
No, don't call
Have you read my bio?
We're looking for positive.
Yes. So that ended up being fine. Splashed down at 2:15. Everything was perfect. All great. So now he's scheduled for another mission in March of 66. He is scheduled for a mission on the new Apollo program. And this is the first spaceship that the astronauts themselves have not been involved in creating. The capsules, they all had, because each one of the seven had a specific job to do. And most of those jobs revolved around the equipment that they would carry or the spacecraft itself. And they all helped design
the capsule. They were aeronautical engineers.
So this Apollo mission is the first one that they've not
The bureaucrats designed. Thought they could do it better.
Yes, they did. So he's really, really unhappy with it. He's like, this is not right. We don't like it. There's all kinds of problems. But he's tasked to be the head of this mission. So on January 22nd, 1967, he goes home before returning to the Cape to fly in this mission. They have a lemon tree in their backyard. There's a huge lemon on it. He walks out to the backyard, picks a lemon. He tells Betty, I'm going to hang this on that capsule with a sign around it. And, yeah, because he's pissed. He's like, this doesn't work. It's had all of these problems. I have lists of the problems. However, they were unable to do one last test before they did this other test with all of the astronauts inside. So on January 27th, 1967, during a pre-launch test on pad 37, they have all of the astronauts inside, which included Grissom, White, and Chaffee. They're inside the closed command module. And there was a fire. And it completely went up in flames. No oxygen could reach the inside. And they all asphyxiated.
Aw, poor Betty.
Yes. So, Alan Shepard is next. And he was born in 1923. He was a flight naval trainer at the Corpus Christi Naval Air Force Air Station in Texas, obviously. He, in 1959, the newly created NASA asked him to be a part. On May 5th, 1961, only 23 days after Yuri Gagarin's mission, who was the first man in space.
The cosmonaut.
Shepard, who, I have to say, of all the astronauts, I like objectively did a poll. I had a picture of all of them on one screen and I showed it to child number one and I said, which one is the least good looking?
That could be skewed though, because there's a TikTok where this woman shows her 16-year-old 80s heartthrobs. And the ones that we all thought were like...
the hottest?
Yeah, she's like, ew.
Well, she also picked Alan Shepard, but apparently, according to the tell-all book that was published later, although his wife never left him, he was the biggest of the wolves of all of the Mercury 7. But anyway, so he went up in space just a few days after Yuri, and he was only a 15-minute, 28-second flight. It was still history-making, though, because Gagarin's flight... typical of Russians, was secret and quiet. Nobody's going to talk about it. And the United States did theirs on freaking TV.
Fanfare.
Here you go. He's going in space. And he does, and he comes back, and everything is fine. After his Mercury flight, he begins continuing work. In 1967, he woke up one morning feeling very nauseated. They found that he had some inner ear thing called Marinese syndrome, which caused all kinds of problems, and he was unable to continue. In 1969, he finally decided to have an operation on his ear, and everything was fixed, and he was restored to full flight status on May 7th, 1969. He was chosen for the Apollo 14 crew along for the lunar module flight. And on January 31st, 1971, Shepard and Mitchell landed on the moon.
The moon.
He hit golf balls on the moon because he was a golfer.
Big golfer.
Yep. He said they used geological tools. They did all kinds of tests. And it was great. And then he ended up passing away from leukemia in 1996. So the first seven astronauts were an admirable group of individuals chosen to sit at the apex of a pyramid of human effort. They were lionized by laymen and adored by youth as heroes before their courage was truly tested.
So from the Disney show, who's the one, if you read it, I don't know if you did, but or it could have been fictionalized because it was from the Disney series.
Right. I've only watched the Housewives series.
Who's the one that had like a broken hand and still did the test flight?
I don't remember.
He like, okay, so you'll see it in the yeah. show. But he goes out drinking, like punches a wall or something, like messes his hand up, and then he can't use his hand and he can't close the hatch of his plane and has to have somebody else do it for him because he can't tell anybody.
Right.
That he...
Okay. Just based on what I know, I'm totally speculating here, people. Based on what I know from the stupid research that I did and the TV show about the Housewives, my guess would be Shepard.
That was my guess, too.
Sounds like something he would do. From what I know of his personality based on my reading, totally sounds like something
I'm going to have to go back and like start anew from that series.
We're starting that tonight. Yeah. I'm very, very excited about it. And I know that was like a bunch of garbly gook, and you're like, my walk is over, has been over for 20 minutes, and I'm bored. But it's fascinating, and it's so interesting, and maybe we'll do one on hero John Glenn. Because not only was he awesome, but so many of the rest of them either cheated on their wives or got divorced multiple times. Had one guy had like a bunch of different kids from a bunch of different women, which there's nothing wrong with, but John Glenn just married, you know, his
the
love of his life, and stayed married forever, and they had two kids, and he did, I mean, he had
grew
the
into an older man, punched out somebody.
Out somebody, probably did. He had a little bit of a savings and loan scandal regarding campaign contributions. Not a big deal. And he went to freaking space at 77.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I'm not going to go to space at 49.
I'm not good enough at space to know how to get there. Elon Musk, if you want me to go to space, call me and let me know.
Elon Musk took a bunch of dead astronauts' ashes to space.
Oh, interesting.
But you wouldn't let me talk about that.
I edited that out for you.
Because I had all of the different astronauts whose ashes went to space.
Well, we've probably been talking long enough. Since we're not experts at space.
Not experts at space.
Just, not but this experts was a good at, drink, though.
This so was a very good drink. I still have plenty that I'm going to continue to drink.
We're probably drunk, so.
Oh, I think I am.
As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things topics you want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay. If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is
Patreon.com/CrimeAndTimeOTR.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.